If I cared, girl. If I fucking cared. If I gave a solitary fuck about Dawn.
Hello and welcome back to The Cinephiles, where we are continuing our exploration of Sexy Beast. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. This is John Rogue. I'm a writer, producer, and host here in San Diego, California. And yes, we are back for part two of Sexy Beast, Steve. And I'm really excited to be diving back in. And we got some great responses for part one from a lot of our listeners. So clearly they are on board to see what happens next with Dawn Logan, who apparently is going to come back now. When last we left, he was taken off and we both were convinced he wasn't going to come back. But that's not true, is it?
Well, John, I don't know. I mean, he's getting on a plane. I mean, people get on a plane to leave. So, no, I'm going to stick with it. I think he's gone for good.
Speaking of which, we cut to him at the airport as this unsettling music kicks in and ratchets up the tension. He stands there still, but having a truly scary, which you imagine a truly scary internal monologue as he slightly sways with these clenching fists and blinking eyes. And then we get to him in his seat on the plane. And as I said, the Spanish air hostess walks up because he's smoking in his seat and tells him he can't smoke on the plane. He is defiant about it. And I don't know if you noticed this, but he stares at her breasts the whole time while he's talking to her to unsettle her and tells her she'll have to wait until he puts out the cigarette and she walks off. A passenger reaches over and says, "Why don't you just put it out?" And Dawn turns and calls him Sancho.
"You want me to cut your hands off? Use it as an ashtray." "Yeah, I'll put it out, providing you're prepared to let me stub it out on your eyeball."
Which makes that guy kind of sit back in his chair and not say
anything. Yeah.
As the hostess returns with security, before they get to him, Dawn whispers to himself and says, "Here comes the, quote, gay brigade," grabs his briefcase, gets up, walks out past the security guys, past the air hostess, and before he can get off the plane,
"I hope this crashes."
Which is insane. Now, Steve, did Dawn do this on purpose because he's embarrassed he couldn't get Gal to commit to the job, or because he does want to be with Jackie, so he purposely smokes on the plane so they throw him off so he doesn't have to leave?
Yes, I think he does it on purpose so he doesn't have to leave. The balance between the Gal and the Jackie of it all, I don't quite know, but he can't lose.
No.
If he goes home, he is now lost.
Yeah.
And so he has to go back.
I think that's what is going on in his mind as he's standing there slightly swaying, not moving, but slightly swaying, and the blinks are happening and the fists are clenching. He is having this internal monologue about what just happened here. How do I get out of it? How do I come to an excuse? How do I get out of it? No, I still want to get him. No, I still want Jackie. No, and that leads to him smoking the cigarette. So in a way, he's not actively making the decision to stay. He's essentially lying to himself that other people are making him stay, because they wouldn't let him smoke the cigarette on the plane. It's a very fucked up guy. Clearly,
it's also just what's weird about it watching it now is I have seen lots of footage of people on airplanes not listening to the flight attendant and obeying whatever it is they're saying and wigging out. And so it was sort of weird watching this in a movie, 20 years earlier, I'm sure you've been in this situation where somebody at the store or at some place was acting out, and it's weird.
I don't have an instinct to turn my phone on, though, and videotape it. I don't understand that, because I get really unsettled. And I know it's probably crazy people think this because I'm a passionate guy and can be at times in people's faces. I get real unsettled with shit like that when I'm witnessing it in person, because I feel bad for the person. I don't know why they're flipping out like this in public. And especially when I watch the plane videos, I don't understand what happens to people on planes that make them flip out. All I want to do is get on a plane, sit in my seat, put on my headphones, and fucking disappear.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, but some people get on there and they've got all this stuff going on and it explodes. And I just don't know what it is. Is it being in a compressed area? Is it being around a bunch of people? I just don't know what triggers it, but we've seen a lot of it over the last few years, and it's just kind of so weird to see,
I mean, I think it is, what I think it is the culmination of 75 things leading up to that moment. What I mean? The average day, that person, for the most part, and I've heard interviews with some of these people who said, like, no, I had a, like, there was a woman who yelled at someone at a Walmart or something like that. It was horrible. And then it went on the tour of, like, no, I had a psychotic break, you know, like, this is, it was COVID and this happened and this happened and my marriage was falling apart and this was happening and this, and then I lost it.
Yeah.
And it's funny for me, and I haven't been in the extreme of these situations, but I've certainly been in situations where someone was wigging out. My instinct is, oh, I should go try to solve this problem. You know, I should go step in between people and go, hey, everyone, let's try to. It's not always, not a good instinct.
Because not everyone's as emotionally mature in those moments as you want them to be, unfortunately.
No, but I sometimes think, like, I can, maybe I can talk to people and we'll work it out.
All right, we cut to him in a cold holding room with two guards watching over him. The interrogator walks in, tells him it's serious, and he's been there. And then Don says, yes, it is serious, and he's been there for 4 5 hours. Don then claims for the second time in the movie that he's been violated by somebody on his, quote, front bottom, and that a second steward was looking at him suggestively. He calls the guy over to speak to him privately and essentially accuses these two male guards of, or male air hostesses of assaulting him.
Now, I don't know whether they wanted me for a twos-up or something. I don't know how they work it. But I tell you what, it scared me. I was shaking like a leaf. So, without thinking, I lit up a cigarette to calm my nerves.
And then he says he doesn't want to kick up a fuss because he's such a magnanimous person. Doesn't want the person to lose his job. Doesn't want to go through the British embassy. No, the kind and caring Don Logan doesn't want to get the man fired. He just wants his boss to have a word with him. Let him know he's been rumbled. And it's the ginger-haired one, in case you're wondering which one it was. always coming for the ginger people, for God's sakes. Steve, thoughts on this scene? Because Kingsley said in a recent interview... Oh, wait, like, thoughts on this scene. Tell me what your thoughts on this scene, brother, and we'll move on to the rest.
I don't know what the craziest scene in this movie is. What's so funny, it just... But it works.
Yeah.
I mean, if his goal is he is in trouble, but, you know, he wanted to get off the plane.
Yeah.
But he got off the plane in a way that landed him security. Now he has to get out of security.
Yeah.
And he comes up with a story. And sure enough, that gets him out of this situation.
Right.
But boy, is it weird. Those are my entire thoughts on this scene.
And I also think this reinforces how much of a terrible person Don is that he would fake a sexual assault story to get out of the situation.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right?
Absolutely.
So kind of in case you were feeling sympathy for Don for being like a man child or being emotionally, shall we say, having issues with his emotions, this kind of reinforces the fact that he is a bad guy. Because it's not the great thing about Sopranos. Every once in a while, when you started to feel sympathy for Tony, they'd have Tony do something pretty terrible. And you as the audience would have to be like, ah, shit, do I still like him? God, I feel guilty. I kind of was cheering for him. So I love that about the Sopranos. And I think this moment is that moment in the movie as well. All right, so we cut back to the house. The music is happier here. H and Gal are sitting on Gal's bed like two old friends, shooting the shit about the situation with Don.
I'm saying he has to save face, protect himself, his image, his ego, his big ego.
Just then, Don pulls up, comes bursting out of the taxi, yelling about them, thinking that he's stupid, a cunt, and some fucking twat. He says his ears were burning in the cab. Probably because Don himself was working himself up into a frenzy. Gal, H, Dee Dee, and Jackie come out, and now we have the full terror of an unhinged Don unleashed on all four of them. H tries to ask about the plane in a nervous way of trying to calm the situation, prompting Don to unleash two full gun barrels of hate on him.
No fucking problem with the plane, cunt. Fucking plane was fine. Fucking plane was all right. Fucking plane was perfect. It's you. You're the problem. You're the fucking problem. You fucking Dr. White, onkin, jam, rag, arkin, spunk, bubble. I'm telling you, H, you keep looking at me, I'm going to put you in the fucking ground. I promise you.
Which is incredible, because as Don gets going, H starts to look down. Jackie looks down. Even Dee Dee looks down because of how terrifying Don is being here. Gal tells Dee Dee to take Jackie and H inside. Dee Dee asks Don if he wants a drink, and he calls her a cunt as well and asks, quote, to see if the ladies let you try on one of their panty girdles. Gal stops him and yells at him, and Don tells him to shut up as they head to the back. And as Dee Dee, Jackie, and H look on from the living room windows, Don melts down.
No, 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 not this fucking time, no fucking way, no fucking way, no fucking way, no fucking way. You made me look a right cunt.
and then wonders out loud randomly what Jackie is going to say about him coming back. Not that he cares. And then he lays into Gal some more, calling him Porky Pig and hiding behind his wife's skirt.
I don't give two fucks what Jackie Big Tits thinks about me coming back. She can think what she fucking likes. I've got enough fucking information on her. So if she's got a pretty face, that could all change. Age changes that. I'm looking forward to seeing her when she's 70. See if she's still coming the cunt, the face like a wrinkled prune. Can't fucking wait. Age to be well gone by then.
And then he says he's going to kill Gal and then kill him, which I think implies H. And then he grabs a liquor bottle off that tray and shatters it across Gal's face. This is the moment where we've crossed the line past friendship and the back and forth and the yelling and the ball busting. And we've gone to a child that has no other option but to use violence. Jackie screams as Dee Dee runs out to check on Gal. Just then, Enrique, who had been hanging off to the perimeter in the darkness somewhere by the pool, apparently, runs up with a rifle pointed at Don, the same rifle from the one they were using with the bunny. Dee Dee goes running back into the house, and Don menacingly walks towards Enrique, tells him, go ahead and shoot. And then disarms him and knocks him down with the butt of the rifle. And then Jackie comes out with a loaded shotgun, points it at Don. Don slowly turns and looks at her. And both Don and Jackie have a don't fuck with me look on their faces. And then we stop. So, Steve, your thoughts on this scene, him coming back full rage, destroying everything in his path, and essentially initiating the conflict that's going to happen, and his getting shot by Jackie by hitting Gal over the head with that bottle.
Well, there's a lot.
Yes, there is.
I would say the first thing is, and my guess is that you could explain to me that all of the rant from Don actually is British slang that does make sense.
Yeah, yeah, I guess, yes.
But there's a certain point where I don't even know if he's, it's like he's out of body. You know what I mean? Like words are just flying out.
Yeah, I wrote down in my notes, he is talking in tongues, in like De Niro at the end of Cape Fear almost. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the first thing. The second thing, you know, we felt that we had escaped.
Yes.
You know, like he left. Right. And it's funny too, because there's the difference. I mean, Don never gets to full violence in the sense that we don't actually see him kill anybody.
Right.
But the difference between the potential of violence that exists in the first set of scenes with Don.
Yeah.
And then what happens in this scene where it's all out in the open is profound.
Yeah.
And it's just watching him target each person. He targets Gal. He targets H. He targets Jackie. He targets Dee Dee. Like all of that. And what I love too is like the arrival of Enrique, you know, is just like, in particular, because he arrives with the rifle that we know is going to misfire. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, right. Exactly.
You know, it's like, oh no, because I don't know that kid's not going to get killed. Anybody could get killed at this moment.
I think Don was absolutely going to kill everybody.
Yeah.
I think Don had crossed that line. And I think at the end, he'd have been like, oh my God, what have I done? But he'd have killed everybody, 100%.
Yeah, I think it is absolutely terrifying. And again, I picture Ben Kingsley and Gandhi.
Yeah.
And then I picture not just the contained intensity we've seen through all of this and the stillness and the oddness we've seen, but now just the explosion that we see here. It's pretty amazing.
Well, if Gal had just cleaned the toilets like everybody else, he wouldn't have lost his mind.
Yep, there you go.
Remember the Gandhi scene when he does that to his wife. All right, so after this scene, and I love this sequence because, again, this is a cornered person in his mind. He has probably been sitting in that taxi cab just fuming with these inner dialogue, inner narratives about what they're saying about him. And all they essentially said was that Don's going to have to save face in some way, and they're just glad that Don is gone. None of them were, I mean, he was called a cunt by H, but Gal calls him that, but none of them were like going off about Don or whatever. They were just happy to have Don out. But in Don's mind, he thinks they've been talking. So the fact that he's ready to go and unleashes that fury on H and then crosses that, I think the crossing of the line by hitting Gal first, I think that's important. Like Dee Dee, Jackie, H, that would have been rage. The fact that he's willing to start with Gal, I think is essentially the end of it for him. And in a way, he's almost challenging them to kill him. And even tells Enrique, pull the trigger, which I think he is kind of asking Enrique to do for real.
Oh,
because Don can't handle his emotions about the situation.
I think he is at best indifferent to whether Enrique actually kills him.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And possibly wants him to.
I want to say this before we go forward, because I wasn't sure where to put this, and maybe this is the right place to put it, but because of what happens in this scene. Kingsley said in a recent interview that Don Logan was inspired by his maternal grandmother.
Oh, wow.
Who he called murderous and terrifying. This was his quotes. She was an extremely violent and unpleasant woman. She was racist, fascist, and anti-Semitic. When I play great heroic Jews and great heroic dark people, I'm sticking two fingers in the air up at her. When I played Don Logan, I was channeling her. And he also says that he took inspiration from Iago in Shakespeare's Othello, which you can see him talk about on the GQ stuff. And there's a great interview with him with Charlie Rose for like half an hour where he talks about being in this movie, which you can find on YouTube. He says, being a great lover of Shakespeare, having played Othello, but not Iago, I did see that Don Logan was definitely Iago. His cry, his scream was, I love you. Why don't you love me? Another cry from the script is, I don't want you to be happy. Why should I? And he says, Don was an abused child, unhealed, who would go on to scream for the rest of his adult life. Therefore, I had a compassionate link with him and understood his capacity for revenge and violence against a fate that had abused him as a child. So I became quite fond of Don Logan. So, interesting.
I'm fond of Don Logan. Is it interesting? Well, you know, but actually, right. I mean, I am sure you have played evil characters.
Oh, yes.
And loved it and had a great time doing it.
I mean, the outlaw was kind of evil initially. Yes,
yeah.
Go ahead. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, playing the heel is fun. So I get that. I'm terrified about his maternal grandmother. Is that what
yeah.
it was?
Yeah.
Okay, that's freaking terrifying.
That's scary as hell.
Yeah, I and the Iago thing makes perfect sense.
Yes,
because he's you know, got all this jealousy and all this emotion that is motivating to do this stuff. I wanted to point out one other thing before we move on, because we often talk about screenplay structure and there are these terms in screenplays that I think people take too seriously, but they are important. And in terms of how a movie is structured, and this is a perfect movie to look at to see those terms in action. So the inciting incident is the moment you've established what the situation is, and the inciting incident is something happens and now everything has changed.
Yeah.
And in this case, when Jackie and H walk into the restaurant and something has happened, that is an inciting incident. And it usually happens halfway through the first act. And then we talk about Don for a while. When Ben Kingsley shows up, that's the end of Act One. And Act Two is Ben Kingsley, is Don Logan, and dealing with him in Spain.
Yeah.
And now at this moment, right after this thing's gone to a climax and we're not quite sure what happened and we're going to end up in England, that is the end of Act Two and the beginning of Act Three. It is super, absolutely crystal clear in this screenplay how it works.
That's a great point. Absolutely great point, Steve. And as Steve said, we end up in London because we cut to a taxi cab that pulls up to the Grosvenor Hotel in the rain. Gao gets out and we see him taking a shower. We see the bandage from the wound with fresh blood on it that Don put on his head there on the shower floor. He sits on the bed naked. We cut later to the nighttime and he gets a call. And as he heads down, we hear Don's voiceover from earlier with details about the job. He's driven to an underground location by some guys. No words are spoken in this car. Jonathan Glazer, for some, I think, really smart reason, turns down the audio on these exchanges to kind of reinforce that Gal is very much in this kind of numb, I don't know what's going on, I'm trying to process everything and put on a good face type of place. Stan calls him over to talk to Teddy, and they both interrogate him, Stan and Teddy, about Don not arriving back from Spain.
So you didn't see him get on the plane then?
Well, no, not personally, no. But I know he got on the plane.
How?
Because he called me from Heathrow.
He called you?
Yeah, he called me. What's that?
Why did he call
you? I don't know. He just said he landed safely. I thought it was a bit funny myself.
And Stan asks Teddy if he's done with Gal. And when Teddy says yes, Gal guiltily reaches for Teddy's hand again to try to shake it, to maybe think that kind of smooths things over. And there's a great effect here from Jonathan Glazer where you see these lights flicker behind Gal as he's walking, which essentially mirror what's happening in Don's mind, that all these synapses are going at once and that he's scared about if he's saying the right thing, if he can stay somehow one step ahead of Teddy in all of this. The camera spins around then, and as we see guys who will be doing the job laughing as they sit around a table in cheap suits, yellow teeth, smoking, wearing knockoff jewelry, in my opinion. Then Gao gets up, which is a great casting decision, all these people. So Gal gets up and call Dee Dee. One of the guys watches him as he gets up to walk over there.
Dee, I love you like a rose loves rainwater, like a leopard loves its partner in the jungle. Like, I don't know what like, I love you.
He tells Dee Dee it's just one day and that she needs to hang on.
I just want you to do one thing for me, just one. Just say my name for me. Just once.
Gal.
And then they hang up. We cut to Enrique watching as the water is being refilled in the pool, signifying that it's Saturday and the kids survived the night we just saw scenes from with Don. We cut back to London as Gal eats breakfast in the Grosvenor. He sees Teddy pull up. Just then, we see this the male rabbit that we had seen from his nightmare saunter in here in the daytime. Clearly a vision that Gal is having. But he saunters in. We hear the spurs jangling. He's swinging his gun. And as he points it at Gal, the man rabbit becomes Teddy.
Tell me again.
Just so you got back safe?
No. He didn't do that.
How'd you mean?
I mean, he didn't do that.
You did.
No, he didn't. He didn't phone you from Heathrow.
I'm the one who got the call. If you know something different, then tell me.
And Teddy just stares at him as he says he's not lying. And we quickly cut to Dee Dee shooting Don with the shotgun so we know that he is lying. And we cut back to Teddy, who smiles and says in the soft voice,
okay. All right. Good luck tonight.
And then we cut to Don yelling as he's been shot, as Teddy laughs and then gets up and walks away. So, Steve, your thoughts on this here? He ended up taking the job, but we see as this sequence goes along that Dee Dee did shoot Don. Don has been screaming and clearly probably dies, as we find out in the movie. He does die. But Gal is having to keep it all together. And somehow, just like the boulder missing him, just like someone else shooting Don and not him, somehow surviving all these things, he's got to survive one more time here in this situation with Teddy. And Don, in essence, did get Gal to go and do the job, even though it cost Don his life. So what are your thoughts on this whole sequence here in London leading up to the confrontation between Teddy and Gal over breakfast?
So you know how I said when we had the what you called the inception sequence, that was this sequence that was all about editing, but the editing really had to be on the page and it had to be directed with intention. This one, I don't know. I'm very curious about whether or not because what happens is you're in this unbelievably tense situation.
Yeah.
And then we're in London at this hotel and he's obviously taking the job. And I, as the audience, am going, what the fuck just happened? You know, now, and for this one, it's like, it could have been exactly this way in the script, or they could have had it more linear in that you see them kill Don and then go to London. And then they decided in post that it didn't quite work. And I'm kind of curious of how it came about because it's super unsettling. You see the blood in the shower. You're like, okay, something has happened, but why, I guess he's taking the job. And why is he taking the job? And then we're at this, he has this lie about him going to Heathrow. And when he lies about him going to Heathrow, that's when I start to go, I think Don might be dead.
Yeah.
And the thing too, by the way, I think Gal does a really good job and the actor does a really good job of pulling off the lie 94%.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Almost believable. Almost perfect.
It's not quite 100% there. And again, we talked about this tons of times on the Cinephiles, is really good actors hit that just right. Like, oh, I totally failed at the lie. I'm perfect at the lie, or somewhere in that gray area. I think the scene on the phone where he's calling Dee Dee, it's like high school. It's like, you say it first. Come on, say so. And the fact that she's not even speaking and then says his name, I think is beautifully done. And again, this cheesy rabbit monster, but it still totally works. And that scene eating and Teddy, again, Teddy being just the opposite of Don.
Yeah.
In that he's just smiling. He knows.
Yes.
I think he knows that Don is dead. I think he knows that Gal is lying.
Yeah.
I also think he knows that he needs Gal on this team.
Yes, to do the job.
And what we find out later is he doesn't care about Dawn. No. Like it's totally immaterial to him. He just wants the answer. And it is so scary. And then the moment of cutting back and going like, oh, Dee Dee shot him. I think it works really, really well.
Yeah. And I think this is Ian McShane. And this is why you cast someone like Ian McShane for scenes like this, right? Because he plays that menace so well with just the steely-eyed stare. And as opposed to Don, who has to go, yes, yes, no, no. Teddy's just staring at him, waiting for Gal to crumble. He doesn't have to say anything. Gal will eventually show his hand. Teddy's an old old school guy, and he's done this for a long time. And it's probably what's allowed him to survive and succeed in this business is he has an innate ability to tell when someone is telling the truth and when someone is lying. And as you said, he also knows when to enact his revenge and when not to, which is after the job, not before the job, because he needs Gal for the job. And he knows that. He just wants Gal to know in some part of himself that Teddy suspects something else is going on here. And I don't think Teddy knows fully that Gal is lying until this scene. I don't know how you feel about it, but the way Gal is trying to eat his food and the way Gal doesn't show any kind of concern for Don and is just keeps eating his food, I think to him that solidifies that Gal knows more about the situation than he's letting on.
I think Teddy's so unknowable.
Yeah,
well, you know what I mean? Like,
very true.
Like, but I think you're right. I don't know. I think Teddy's just way ahead of everybody. So yeah, I think you're probably right. I don't know if it's the way he's eating the food. I don't know if it's, I mean, I think Teddy knows about Don getting kicked off, going off the plane. I think he knows about the little meeting in the security room.
Which he does later tell Gal the same thing. Yeah.
Because by the way, again, always want to give tips to those liars out there, is that the Heathrow call is a bad lie.
Yep.
What he should have said was he left to go to the airport. When he originally left to go to the airport, I called him a cab. That's the last time I saw him.
Yep.
100%. That's a much better lie because there's nothing you could check. Because that, in fact, everything is true. I called him a cab. He went to the airport. And then even if Teddy looks up and sees that he never left Spain or got kicked off the airport, but if you say he called me from Heathrow, now you're in a lie that can be checked and you're going to get, that's a problem.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Cause maybe you can pay off the taxi driver to not tell Teddy that the taxi driver took him back to Gal's place.
Right.
Like that's the only strand of that story that you'd have to wrap up in some way before you told Teddy that. Yeah. He didn't come back and, you know, he went on the plane. Yeah, for sure. And we cut to Gal in his hotel room, hurriedly packing up his things, Steve, and then throwing him against the wall and sitting on the bed. So, I mean, where can he go that Teddy won't find him, right, Steve?
I think he figures that out right away, right at that moment. He goes like, what am I going to do?
Exactly. And we cut to later. It's the night of the robbery. Gal is being driven there by some guys and Stan is in the car. You know, Stan's such an interesting character, Steve, because Stan doesn't say much, but he becomes this kind of like shadowy character throughout the back half of the movie that adds to Teddy's intimidation. So we could argue, Steve, that there are three antagonists in this movie that carry varying levels of dread and danger for Gal, I would argue.
Well, these are criminals, John. I mean, you know, I mean, honestly, I bet Gal, you know, 15, 20 years ago, he's a lovable lug now.
Yeah.
I don't think you messed with Gal 20 years ago.
I bet that's a great point. I never even thought about that. But Gal might've been Teddy's strongest muscle at one point, and now he's just gotten softer, you know, a little bit. So yeah. Well, we cut to a flashback of Teddy walking by the steam bath sign, which is highlighted there by Glazer, essentially let us know that this is how they're going into the robbery. We hear the Don, Stan, and Teddy VO that we had talked about earlier about the Inception flashback situation about a will and a fucking way. And we cut to a close-up of Teddy and we go through his head, Steve. This is so interesting. You as an editor into a fast motion POV shot of the camera moving down that street at night, into the vaults, down the many floors, through the walls of the vaults, and then up the drill out into the underwater steam bath. Steve, your thoughts on these shots in this fast motion edit, did this impress you from a first time filmmaker or did this strike you as a music video type of thing that makes sense in the way it was used in this movie?
I think this is a perfect example of why giving an Oscar for best editor is always a mystery because I think this works really well. I also think like the speeded up shot could have been that they didn't intend to do it sped up, and then they realized it was too slow.
Right.
Because what's interesting about this movie is, as you said, I think in part one, is that this is a heist movie.
Yeah.
But we don't really care that much about the heist.
No.
You know?
We're not invested in them pulling this off at all.
And so propelling us in to the middle of the heist really, really quickly, which is what we're doing right now, makes perfect sense. Because doing the heist, which is the most important thing in The Sting or in Ocean's 11, is the least important thing in Sexy Beast, you know?
The heist we are invested in, though, Steve, is if Gal can essentially steal his life back from Teddy, because it looks like Teddy has his life in a box and can take him out at any moment, as we've seen over the last few scenes.
How long are we looking at?
At least another 3 hours, Ted. Maybe four.
Nah, fuck that. Two and a half.
Steve, what is he doing here? Is he trying to massage Teddy a little bit to be like, hey, I'm invested. I'm one of the good guys. Don't get mad at me. What do you think he's doing here in trying to curry favor with Teddy?
Honestly, I don't get the moment. I think that something like that is supposed to be happening.
Yeah.
But that's not how I feel. Like, it just feels a little odd to me. What's your feeling about it?
Well, Steve, clearly you're not a person who's stolen stuff and tried to get away with it and been caught. Because I'm telling you right now, I've been in that moment. I've occasionally taken things. And certainly that moment or crossed lines and you try to curry favor with the person that you've offended. That's essentially what I think Gal is doing here, the Teddy, by being like two and a half and then sneaking the look at him like, hey, he's essentially trying to smooth things over with Teddy by being positive about this and by working even harder to get Teddy the money and to break what other people are considering the job will take in terms of time. And so he looks like he's a good person to Teddy. He looks like he cares and he did want to do the job. So I think that's what's going on. He's trying to essentially gaslight Teddy into believing that Gal was totally invested in getting this job done.
And John, you are 100% right. I have never stolen things and been caught.
I've
never been caught.
Yeah, never been caught. I think that's the essential term there, part of that sentence. Okay. We cut to a bunch of shots of them drilling and moving bricks as Gal goes back in through this tight tunnel they've drilled out. And suddenly, Steve, we hear animal-like noises coming out of the opening. And it's Dawn with this gunshot wound in his stomach, and we are back at that night. This is the second time that Glazer uses underwater imagery to bring us into some mode or feeling of what's going on actually on the land, on the surface here. Dawn is screaming in pain and primal anger. And what do you think about this usage to put Dawn here in this moment and have this, like going through this tight tunnel for Gal and then this leading him back, almost like PTSD, leading him back into this night?
You know, we were talking before about the cut to England, like right at the climax of the thing. And then suddenly we're in England and the audience has to catch up and what's going on. And before I said, I didn't know if it was in the script and the original intention or if this nonlinear stuff was added in the editing room.
Yeah.
The more I'm thinking about it now, I think it was added in post. Again, it goes to the same thing. We can't know, you know, what we give the best editing Oscar to because we can't know what they started with. I think this is just my feeling that they and I don't know. And you obviously have researched this movie much more. So maybe they said something about this. But my feeling is that linearly, the final sequence of killing Dawn didn't work for whatever reason. It just didn't fit together right. It was probably, my guess is it probably was too long and they went like, these parts are great, but connecting the parts, the connective tissue is really a problem. Yeah. And so the solution to that is you eliminate the connective tissue because you're going to play it as flashback later on. So we don't have to exactly see how we get from here to here to here.
Yeah.
And so we intercut it with the, and this is totally where editors make their money because it's like that's where the editor is really creating the way the movie works.
Well, and I think the quote that we talked about earlier that I read that Glazer said, like, how do you do a heist movie without shooting a heist movie? As we've referenced already, it's you go back to these other things in the middle of the heist. So it keeps you thinking, yes, the heist is happening, but I also want to know what happened here after Dawn was shot the first time. What was the result, right? Because that's still a mystery for us.
Well, and I just had another, because I actually think I even have a better idea of what was not working.
Okay.
Is the entire tension of the movie is Dawn, right? Mm-hmm. Like Dawn is, and that if you kill the tension of the movie in the middle of the movie,
right,
and we don't care about the heist, which we don't, then the heist is boring.
Right.
That's almost a bigger reason than maybe that killing Dawn didn't work, is they went, all the tension is out of our movie.
You're not invested in the heist, right?
Exactly. So we have to keep the tension alive. So we're not going to show the whole killing of Dawn. And so really, we're making the heist. What's the heist really about? Actually, it's really about the killing of Dawn, because that's the emotional thing that's going on in the scene.
Right, exactly. And speaking of the killing of Dawn, let's go through this. Gal walks over to Dawn, kneels down, and just starts to unleash all his rage on him. I'm sure, Steve, you've maybe had moments in your mind where you've wanted to do this with people who've...
Oh, in my mind. Oh, yes.
Yes. When with every punch, we cut back to the drilling. This is such an interesting decision, Steve, to have the punch mirror the drilling. So essentially, Gal is killing Dawn or punching Dawn as Gal and his cohort there are drilling through. It's two different walls, one mental and physical, and one actual concrete. So it's fascinating that he chooses to edit it this way, to have them kind of mirror each other, which I think is fascinating. Okay, and then Dawn yells at Dee Dee that she fucked hundreds. He kind of blurts this out, because Dawn at this point has just been beaten to a pulp. He's slurring these words, which leads to now Dee Dee joining in with the beating. So now it is Gal and Dee Dee both beating up on Dawn. And as they punch and kick him, Dawn has the wherewithal to turn to his right and see Jackie comforting Enrique, and then calls out to her and says, "Jackie, I love you." And then Jackie, in slow motion, walks over and starts to get her licks in as the music pans away. So now, Steve, we have three people beating the shit out of Dawn. Why does he choose this moment as Gal and Dee Dee are beating on him to say to Jackie that he loves her? Why does it take this kind of emotional moment and physical beating for him to finally admit that he loves Jackie, which is, he could have said an hour ago, would have solved this whole issue? Tell me why he chose this moment to say it.
Well, first of all, it would not have solved the issue if Dawn had said an hour ago, "I love you, Jackie. I don't think this anything better was going to happen." You know, that. But that being said, I think it's totally last words. It is totally.
He's going to get this out before he goes.
Yeah. He's finally admitting his truth in his last moment.
Yeah, and maybe even getting one up on H, because after Jackie comes over and doesn't reciprocate the love and starts to beat on him, Dawn sees H and then screams, "Help me, you cunt." I don't know about you, Steve, but that would make me less inclined to help.
In general, no, that would not be the best cry for help.
Exactly. H is frozen, and then Jackie screams, "H, get the fucking gun!" But H can't move. You know what, Steve? I think H is the biggest coward in the movie.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Throughout. And in this moment, even with Dawn and three people beating the shit out of him, H still doesn't have the wherewithal to move. He just stands still, petrified at what's happening, probably worried about how he's going to survive this situation once the boys back home hear about this. But Dee Dee, ever the warrior, runs back into the house, grabs the shotgun. As Gal moves away, she shoots Dawn again. And then silence as we cut to Teddy in the bath. So, Steve, am I wrong? This scene is almost like sexual in that the pounding is happening, the screaming is happening, and then finally one release and all the silence consumes it. The post-coital silence is there, and we cut to Teddy in the bath. So, am I wrong in making that comparison between the sexuality and the violence here?
I will say, when you first said sexual, I went, huh? What the hell are you talking about?
I mean, but drilling is going on.
But as I'm thinking about it, it's like, well, this is further convincing me that of why they edited it this way, because it is a climax. This is full catharsis, mm-hmm. because we've dealt with the pain and stress of Dawn for this entire movie up to this point.
Yeah.
And now we are all going to get our literal licks in, you know, like everybody piles on in this, you know, moment. And we're going to get H in a moment to add to it. It's like, yes, this is everybody I will use your framing, in an orgy of violence.
Yes.
All coming together to destroy the evil person.
Yeah. And we close up on the evil person, Dawn Logan, as he slurs the word,
"Fuck." "And that's funny." fucking Joker.
Then Don is suddenly in a dark shadow. And I thought this was an interesting decision, Steve, by Glazer, because Don has essentially been the dark shadow over all of them since he arrived. And I think this is the first time we see Don in shadow. And he turns to H and says,
"Fuck, Jackie. Fucked her. Ask her, she'll tell you. I fucked her."
Trying to get, as you said, last words with Jackie into expressing his love, but also last words to H possibly to be like, "I beat you in this. I'm going to one up you," right? Totally. But H finds his guts finally now that Don has been beaten and shot to almost death and says,
"Yeah, well, I'll fuck you now, haven't I?"
And slams an empty toolbox on Don's head. And that is the end of Don Logan. Steve, your thoughts on this? These final bits and pieces.
I like that H has that last moment, and that it's so that because, as you said, he is the least violent, the least scary guy in the movie, and that he is the
and
one
the least who, brave and the least brave.
I would say. And he is the one who finally puts an end to Don Logan. I think is absolutely correct.
Yeah, of all people, that's a great point, Steve. Yeah, Steve, were you surprised at how this ended the first time you saw it? And why does he want to tell H that he fucked Jackie? Is it to let him know that he wins? You know, he's like it reminded me of Masala teasing Ben Hur one last time about his mother and daughter, and saying that the race goes on. It felt very similar to that. Not that H has been her or anything like that, but it felt similar to like to get one last shot in before he goes.
Yeah, totally. Of course, that's what it is. It is Khan saying, you know, "With my last breath, I spit at thee." Yeah. You know, it is, of course, it is the, and particularly if we go with the theory that him having sex with Jackie was actually an affair when she was dating H.
Right.
Then this last sentence is, "Even when I'm dead, I will always come between you and your relationship forever."
Yeah, I will own you in some small way. Right, exactly. Except H really doesn't care by the end. All right, so I want to throw this in because this is an exchange that I thought was interesting from the commentary track here. Jeremy Thomas, the producer, was talking with Kingsley about having a back and forth about Logan's character now that we've come to the end of Don Logan. Jeremy says, "Don's weakness, the only weakness he shows in the piece is admitting to Gal that he, quote, quite likes Jackie." And then Kingsley says, "Don is a character who openly declares his love twice. He says, 'I love you, Gal.' And he also says, 'I love you, Jackie.' It adds a whole dimension to this tortured man." And then Jeremy chimes in and says, "Maybe the only two people he ever really liked, and they didn't want to play with him. They didn't love him.
Oh.
They feared him." And Kingsley, in an interview with Charlie Rose, which I referenced earlier, in 2001, called Don, quote, "the darkness. He is the darker side of my subconscious that we seek to come to terms with. I love that H has ironically become his darkness and sends Don Logan into the dark by the end," is what I'm saying in reaction to what Kingsley said there. So what are your thoughts on this back and forth between Jeremy and Kingsley here about Don?
What's weird to me, and again, this is why movies are always open to interpretation. Yeah. I think I said earlier is I thought when he's telling Gal that he loves him, that that's just a manipulation. Mm. And they're saying they think he actually does love Gal, which, and again, I go to, well, if you're working with the actor, what's the more interesting choice? And maybe the more interesting choice is actually he really does like Gal, and he likes very few other people in the world. That makes it more interesting, you know?
And the two people who have rejected him in his life, who he actually does love and respect, are in the same place.
Yeah.
And to have the double rejection is what finally sends him over the end. But do you think he was going to kill Gal and kill H?
When he came back tonight?
Yeah.
I think it's very, very possible he kills everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I don't think Don is carefully planning in his head. This is what I think. He is filled with rage. He's an extremely violent person. He is embarrassed. He's jealous. He shows up at this place. Anything could happen. You know,
I feel like he's the kind of guy that would kill all of them and then cry as he buried them and then actually give them a eulogy or something. In some messed up way in his head, right? I feel like about the guy. All right, anyway, we cut back to the job and they burst through the vault wall with a rush of water pouring in. We see the guys yelling and screaming for joy. Teddy disrobes and walks over. They drag everyone out before they can be electrocuted. Then it's quiet as they go through the deposit boxes and take out all the prized possessions, jewelry, money, pearls, diamonds. We see some bondage photos. We see weird hunting photos in the safari with natives in these oversized masks. I think they're natives. Steve, what is your take on those bondage and hunting or safari photos? Like, why does Glazer include that as a part of all of this as you're watching it happen?
I think it's just, you know, we don't need to see bearer bonds like in Die Hard. You know what I mean? He went, and actually when you go into the safe in Die Hard, there's also statues and art and things like that. Right. I'm sure he was thinking, well, I'm not going to have statues and art. And we established that Teddy lives in a very strange, and so does Harry live in a very strange world. So it's there. But I'll tell you the honest truth. I'm so not involved in the heist. You know what I mean? Like, other than the fact that, like, wow, this is really weird. We have an underwater heist and everything's floating around and it's kind of interesting, but I'm not emotionally involved. So it's, I think it's one way to kind of pique our curiosity, but beyond that, I don't have a lot of opinion of
it. Yeah. I think it's a commentary on the level of depravity that the people who are this rich have. And I think that's why they included that here, Glazer, and the writers include that in here, is to show, like, this is the kind of fuck off wealth that some of these people have and the kind of loss of human connection that they have when they reach that level. So anyway, we go back and Gal opens a box here with some beautiful earrings inside of it, looks around and then takes them for himself. I can assume that he's going to give them to Dee Dee. And then someone, because these are a bunch of lunkheads, stupidly opens an urn underwater, lets out the human ashes, which freaks everyone out. And that ends the scene. Just to give a little background on the vault, they built it in a shed in North London. This is not actually a real vault, even though everything around it felt like you were leading to a real vault. No, it was not. It was raining a lot, says Jeremy Thomas, the producer here, and they had a lot of difficulty keeping all of that aluminum foil in there and stopping the rain from dripping through the roof. And then, of course, somebody was behind each of the boxes underwater, pushing them out with their hand. So Glazer said it's very hard to have a film about a heist and do these kinds of things. So interesting stuff, Steve, for sure.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp.
Hey, Steve, the year has gone by so quick, and I can't believe we're already in June. We're in the middle of the movie season here, and we're already looking at 2025 and movies that are coming out in 2025. It's crazy, but, you know, it's important before life goes too fast that you take a moment to celebrate some of your wins. And I want to ask the Cinephiles audience, what's something you're proud of in 2024 that you've done? What's something you will want to accomplish this year? When you take stock like that, you have to make adjustments. You look at adjustments you can make. And I tell you what, therapy, Steve, can help you take stock of your progress and set achievable goals for you over these next 6 months.
Well, and this is what's really worked for me, is to take those moments with a therapist to take stock of your year. And that means both looking back at the things you really have accomplished so you can feel good about them, because sometimes we let those things slide. But it also means looking forward at the things you have left to do and figuring out a strategy of how to approach the year as time is moving faster and faster.
You're absolutely right, Steve. As you move up in life, you got to develop coping skills. You've got to develop boundaries for certain stages that are going on, certain things are happening in your life. And if you're thinking about starting therapy, which really helps you do that, you got to give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and then you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge if it's not working out.
So take a moment and visit betterhelp.com/cinephiles today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CINEFILES.
Hey, the Cinephiles fans. During the summer, Steve and I love to keep Fiji water on hand to keep us hydrated and refreshed, and it really is from the islands of Fiji. Drop by drop, Fiji water collects in a sustainable ancient artesian aquifer 1,600 miles away from the nearest continent, protected and preserved naturally from external elements, Steve.
And as the water filters through volcanic rock, it collects a unique profile of electrolytes and minerals, resulting in more than double the electrolytes as the other two top premium bottled water brands. And John, that's what gives Fiji water its soft, smooth taste.
Totally. Unlike some other premium bottled waters, Fiji water's electrolytes are 100% naturally occurring, and this water even has a perfectly balanced pH of 7.7. Fiji water really is Earth's finest water, and since 2022, Its 330 milliliter and 500 milliliter bottles have been produced in 100% recycled plastic, so you can feel proud of your choice in bottled water.
So, John, I think we should get stocked up on Fiji water this summer, and everyone listening should pick up some today for your next backyard party, beach day or pool day, hike, or even just for your home office. It's not just water, it's Fiji water.
All right, we cut to the guys celebrating in the bar as some lounge music plays. Teddy walks into cheers, calls them all cunts, because of course that's the word of the movie, and they all laugh. And Steve, he pulls Gal aside, who has his luggage in his hand, ready to just skip on out of there, get on the plane, and maybe survive. But no, Teddy pulls him aside to have a conversation with him. And as I said, Stan appears out of nowhere from the side of the camera, sits down at the table as well. And then Gal has an interesting reaction, Steve. He finally breaks with this mixture of nervous laughter and even a hint of tears. So what's your thoughts as you're watching Gal reacting to sitting here between Teddy and Stan? Does he sense that he is maybe going to be murdered by both of them?
Totally. I don't think it's just sense. I think he held it together as much as he could. And I think his hope was, and maybe this is connected to the line that you mentioned about 2.5 hours or whatever it was, is that I think his hope was, if I'm the best heist man possible and we pull off the heist and everybody's really rich and happy, I might get off the hook.
Yeah.
And here he goes, I am not off the hook.
At all.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which harkens back to that moment. Like, oh, no, we can get through the 2.5 hours. He's thinking he's maybe bought himself a little bit of favor with Teddy, but he wants to get out of there before he discovers if he hasn't. Anyway, Gal congratulates Teddy and Teddy congratulates everyone and then questions why he doesn't look happy and then asks what's with the bag. So Teddy's not even affected by Gal's nerve. Teddy knows that he's seen this reaction before, totally. I believe, when he has got the goods on someone, seeing them break down, a nervous laugh or whatever. Teddy is, I think, kind of savoring this a little bit. He's savoring the torture of Gal a little bit, I feel like.
What's with the bag? You shooting off.
Which I think is a reference that he may suspect what happened with Don here. Does Teddy know what happened to Don, Steve? And did Gal overplay his hand by bringing his luggage?
So I think Teddy knows that Don's dead.
Yes.
I don't think Teddy necessarily knows how Don died or exactly what happened. And yes, Gal absolutely made a mistake. But I will say this. This was going to go down this way no matter what.
Right. With the baggage or not.
I mean, the bag was a mistake.
Yes.
You know, if there was any chance of him getting away, the bag did not help. But there wasn't any chance of him getting away.
Yeah. So, Gal, and I agree with you. I think there was no chance of him getting away. Him bringing the bag is a mistake he wouldn't have made, as you said earlier, when 10, 15 years ago, when he was under Teddy, no way he makes this kind of mistake. But he's softer, he's heavier, he's in love. He's not thinking that edge way, that sharp way you need to think to survive in a world of gangsters like this. So Gal says he's catching a flight, and Teddy offers to drive him to the airport. Gal tries to refuse, but Teddy's going to do it. And Stan just stays. As they drive in silence, Gal sneaks a look over at Teddy that, to me, mirrors Don sneaking looks at Jackie when Jackie was driving him to the house the first time. Am I off on maybe thinking, because both of those people essentially have power over the person in the passenger seat? Am I trying to make too much of a connection here?
You can make whatever connections you like, John. If you saw that connection and that helped you, and that made the movie better, fantastic. I don't see that connection at all.
Fair enough.
You know, this is the cinephile.
I've been known to make some connections at times that may be a bit too far. But anyway,
I'm just going to stop off for a minute along the way.
They pull up on a massively rich house. Teddy stares at the house and then tells Gal to come in with him. Teddy rings the doorbell twice. Gal can't even look at him. Steve, he looks like a scalded dog. A man walks out and it's Harry from Imperial Emblat there from the vaults.
What do you want? It's 5:10.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I need your help, Harry. Something's happened.
And Gal looks away. Steve, does Gal know that Teddy is going to kill Harry in this moment? Like, has he been on a number of these visits, or shall we say stops, in his past with Teddy?
I think Gal knows that Teddy's going to kill him.
Oh, okay.
That's what I think. I think he said when Teddy says, you know, we need to make a stop, it's like you're in The Godfather and they say, hey, I got to stop and take a leak. You're going to die. That's what I think Gal is certain that he's going to be taken to a place where he's going to die. I don't think he knows who Harry is. I don't think he knows what this house is.
Yeah.
And I, as the odd, but it's so weird to me because I was thinking, shit, Teddy's going to kill Gal. How's Gal going to get away?
Right.
And then Harry comes out and I go, what the fuck is going on? Didn't we just rob that guy? But he had some relationship with the guy. Cause I don't understand the Harry Teddy relationship exactly. I'm suddenly going, wait, was Harry in on the robbery? And that's now there's, I don't know what the fuck is going on.
Yeah. I this is a mystery for me of the movie. And I agree. And I'm glad you brought this up because earlier we were talking about Harry comes off as a guy who has strength. He is very comfortable in who he is. And he, at times, it feels like in his interactions with Teddy that he gets the best of Teddy. He's not intimidated by Teddy. But in this moment when he comes out, he's in his bathrobe, and he's got his arms folded. He's a little bit weaker in appearance to Teddy. And it's Teddy who leads the way into the house as we get back to the movie. Teddy is the one who leads the way into the house, walks ahead of Harry and Gal as they come up the stairs. And he's the one who asks Gal if he wants wants a whiskey. And he tells Harry in his own house to prepare a whiskey for Gal. So the tables have switched now that Teddy has gotten what he wanted, was to break through the vaults and get all that stuff. It's like he doesn't need Harry anymore. So it makes me wonder if this has been a con the whole time by Teddy, both the sexual stuff and everything that just have access to it all. Was this a game between them, and was Harry involved in it or not? And is this the reason he kills Harry? Because Harry was involved and he can't have any loose threads leading back to Teddy.
Yeah. My gut is it's something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it also goes to show why we don't really care about the heist. You know what I mean? Like, right. I care about Robert Shaw getting, nailed at the end of the sting. And I definitely care about Andy Garcia and what happens to him. I don't actually care about Harry.
No.
You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really matter, because what this is really about is Gal.
Yeah. Is Gal going to survive?
Right. Well, and he specifically brought Gal into this house to witness this murder.
Right. Essentially make him an accomplice to murder. Well, this is what I think Teddy's intention is here. We're supposed to be afraid that he's going to kill Gal, but I think Teddy, as he takes that whiskey and shoots Harry in the head and kills him, is to implicate Gal in a murder so that if Gal ever opens his mouth about anything, Gal will go back to jail, which he just got out of, because he witnessed a murder and said nothing. So to me, this is Teddy beginning the process of essentially putting Gal in his place and keeping him there, and making sure he's there and that he's never going to talk about the heist or anything involved with this ever again.
I don't think that's perfectly reasonable. I understand why you say that, because to me, Teddy is so fucking scary. He doesn't need that to scare. He just shot a guy in front of him. I think Teddy is saying, you are dead.
Yeah.
I could kill you right in the second.
Right.
And guess what? If I don't kill you right in the second, I could kill you at any other second I choose. That's how fucking scary I am. I don't think it would ever get to the point, because if you frame Gal, well, Gal can say, no, I saw Teddy kill that person right in front of me. This is how we did that. And these are all, he can name all the names. It's much more dangerous to frame Gal than it is to actually just go, I can kill you and everyone you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's revisit that later. Okay. You might be right, though. Anyway, so after he shoots Harry, Teddy turns and slowly walks to Gal. And this is a great moment by Ian McShane where he just says,
where's Don, Gal? He never left Spain, Gal, I know that. He never got on a plane. Well, he did. And he got off again. And there's no record of him getting another flight. I can only assume he's still in Spain.
And this is an incredible delivery by Ian McShane, Steve, and Gal, who is staring there petrified. Because remember, he didn't react to Harry's death at all. He's almost in a state of shock. And then he just softly says, in this pleading, sad way,
I'm not into this anymore, Ted.
As Teddy just stares at him. Talk to me about this exchange between Teddy and Gal here in this moment.
I think Gal essentially surrenders.
Yeah. Yes.
You know what I mean? Yes. Like, he doesn't actually say, yes, I lied about Heathrow. We actually shot Don because he doesn't confess.
Yeah.
It's the difference between a confession and a surrender. He just says, it's basically like, I have nothing I can say to you.
Yeah.
There's nothing I can do to save my life.
Yeah.
If you're gonna kill me, I guess you're gonna have to kill me. And that's without those words, you know. He just opens up his belly and says, you are the dominant. Whatever's gonna happen is now gonna happen.
If you've ever watched two dogs where one dog essentially becomes dominant over the other dog, it is essentially what you're watching here. It's very animalistic. This whole film is very primal, very animalistic. And in that moment, I think that's what's happening as well, what you said. Gal is essentially showing Teddy his belly. And that's that. Well, we cut to them driving silently in the car, so we clearly didn't kill Gal yet. Teddy asks about Spain ominously and says,
I must drop in sometime. Pay my respects.
He then tells him, in a moment of disrespect, Steve, that he's only paying him £10 for the job. And the orchestral music here, the orchestral music is slightly reminiscent of The Godfather for me. It's so interesting, some of the score here in this moment. Teddy pulls over to the side of the road, and here's the ultimate insult. He makes Gal give him change because he only has £20 on him. Instead of just giving him 20, he makes Gal hunt for change to give him £10.
What's so great about it is, so we assume Gal has essentially lost out of thousands of pounds, right?
Yeah. At least.
Yeah.
2 to 3% of the take was what Don was quoting him before the thing.
And what's so great about it is losing out on thousands of pounds is the greatest gift Gal could ever get. Because what it's saying is probably, because Teddy, I think, could still kill him at any second if he chose to. But but now suddenly Gal, who had just surrendered and had no hope, now it's like, wait, I'm going to might get out of this, you know, getting out of this and not making all that money. That sounds great.
Yeah. And as he takes the change here, Teddy tells Gal,
if I cared, Gal, if I fucking cared, if I gave a solitary fuck about Don.
And then just trails off, Steve. He never finishes the sentence, stares at Gal intensely for a few seconds, and then says,
get out of the fucking car.
And then as Gal barely closes the door getting out of the car, Teddy speeds off, leaves him all alone in the middle of the night at this bus station. Gal adjusts himself to kind of look tough, pulls out the earrings to look at him, smiles to himself. And Steve, I'm going to say this, the boulder has missed Gal one more time in this movie.
Yep.
And perhaps it is the last boulder that will miss Gal, and he survives. What are your thoughts on this final moment between Teddy and Gal and Gal standing there, essentially escaping the boulder for the third time in this movie?
Because it's always interesting when a sentence is not finished.
Yes.
And the sentence that's not finished is, if I gave a solitary fuck about Don, I would kill you.
Yeah, you'd be dead.
You would be dead.
Yeah.
And what I still love about it is Don is so important in this movie. The most important figure in this movie is Don.
Yes.
Teddy doesn't give a solitary fuck about the most important figure in this movie. You know, that is how above Don Teddy is. Yeah. And I love that moment because the other thing he's saying very clearly is, I know you killed him.
Yes.
I am 100% certain that you killed him. And if I cared, I would kill you, but I don't care.
And also says, I'll have to drop in and pay my respects in time to Spain. Yep. In essence saying, I know you killed Don and I'll have to, you know, if I feel like it, maybe. Right. So I'll keep that threat over you at all times. All right, we're back in Spain. Enrique is looking on, who looks fine now, looks recovered from the rifle butt to his mouth. And he is watching H tell Jackie this insane story about a miracle pill that if you got your hair cut a certain way, you could keep it that way for the rest of your life. It would never grow. And when Jackie tries to poke holes in it by saying, well, what if you want to change your haircut? H responds, well, you can take another pill that's essentially the antidote, which causes Jackie to laugh even harder. And then we end this particular back and forth with a commentary about these test monkeys having Beatles haircuts for 2 years, and apparently they're very happy with it. Steve, talk to me about this way to go back into Spain, because Gal is also listening from the swimming pool, smiling. What are your thoughts? Is this essentially kind of a pseudo happy ending to this movie that we're seeing them H telling this story after this very tense scene between Teddy and Gal?
I don't think it's pseudo. I think this is a happy ending. I think, to me, this is exactly the conversation about the different pool waters. You know what I mean? This is just friends who really like hanging out, having ridiculously stupid these are exactly the conversations nobody ever puts in a movie because they're completely unimportant and inane and they're not dramatic in any way.
Right.
And that's what makes this, it's like, oh, we're back. We're back to our lives from before, you know?
It's crazy because H has essentially been comic relief through the movie. Whether it's the color of water in the pool or, you know, telling him how he can get out of the situation that Don's going to claim that Gal was too fat and that he's making commentary about Gal's weight and appearance and all of that. It's kind of comic relief. He is essentially, you're turning the valve so you let the steam out. He lets the steam out of all these really tense moments in the movie. Even when Don first shows up, he's the one that fumbles over himself to try to invite Don to lunch and all of that. That's all to release the tension a little bit in certain moments. And here he is delivering this insane speech about this miracle pill and hairdressers are shitting themselves. And this is all just kind of to let you feel a decompression of the incredible last 20 to 30 minutes that we've been through in this movie, which I think works so well. Then we have a modern remix version of Dean Martin's Sway startup. And Dee Dee asks if Gal wants a sandwich. She's wearing this beautiful red bikini. He says, yes, that'd be lovely. And as Dee Dee walks towards us in slow motion, Steve, we see those earrings that Gal stole from the heist on Dee Dee's ears. But just in case we thought this movie was going to give us a happy ending, Don and Gal have an exchange in his mind about Don being right that Gal would do the job.
You were right, Don. Technically speaking, you were right. But you're dead.
And then smirkingly without fear, he says out loud,
so shut up.
Your thoughts on this weird back and forth between Don and Gal? Does this mean Don will always be a part of Gal because he's buried under the water, essentially, which we're going to get to in a second, but also because he can hear Don's voice in his head? Or is this the last time Gal ever talks to Don?
So I think that's totally open to interpretation, but my interpretation, because you know what? I want to believe in the happy ending.
Yes.
Is that he says, shut up, Don, Don does. That he is back to his life. That is what I want to believe. But one could totally construct that this is the telltale heart, and buried under the pool is the evil and the murder and the violence, and it will never leave Gal's life, and it will drive a wedge between him and Dee Dee, and he'll suffer nightmares forever. That's perfectly valid, and I choose not to believe that.
All right, fair enough. And as Gal looks down, we plunge through the tiles at the bottom of the pool, through the two hearts and deep into the earth. And we see our angry man rabbit again. And he is angrily kicking a wooden coffin open. And when he stops, we cut to a perfectly dressed Don smoking a cigarette, who calmly turns to look at the man rabbit and scoffs at him and turns back and keeps smoking. As we go to black with Dean Martin's Sway playing over the end credits. So, Steve, what does the man rabbit unleashing Don from his coffin and Don scoffing at him mean here as we end the movie?
The last note I have in my notes is, what the fuck does that mean? And I don't have an answer. John, you are much better at symbolism than I. Yeah. What does this mean?
I think Don is at peace. And the angry man rabbit essentially has always indicated moments of danger or anger or frustration or hate in the movie. Okay. And here he is like kicking the coffin open, like, wake up, Don, torture this guy. And Don just scoffs at him and is like, fuck you, I'm done. Like, he's no longer angry. And so in a way, I think that's kind of in a fucked up way showing that there's closure here for Don. And so maybe this happy ending that you want to have to happen has happened, in that even Don himself has found some fucked up peace in the fact that he got to tell Jackie he loves her, got to tell Gal he loves him, and was essentially taken off the earth, and his painful life, which I imagine Don has lived his entire life in some level of emotional and mental pain because of how he's built, is finally over, which is why we see him like perfectly coiffed, smoking his cigarette, confident as hell, no blood on him at all. And to me, that symbolizes that even Don has found closure and is no longer giving in to the angry man rabbit in his soul.
I 100% buy into your interpretation.
That's what I think, you know? And I also think that's the end of Gal's man rabbit as well, because it's all the way buried down there. So it's like the release of this thing, which is why the man rabbit is so angry, because no one, now he cannot torture or bother anybody. And that's why he kicks Don's coffin open. And I think that's what I think.
Release your man rabbit. Everybody, man out throughout the world.
Let it
release
go.
Release your man rabbit.
All right. So that's the end of the movie. Here's some final notes. Steve, Sexy Beast grows $10.2 million on a budget of $4.3 million, making it a relative box office success for that time. In the years since, a total film named Sexy Beast, the 15th best British film back in 2004. And Glazer spoke about the trouble he had making the film because he said, quote, producers earn money largely when the film is made. So when the window is there, there's a need to go and do it quickly. So you're pushed into decisions and things aren't as developed as they should be. And obviously that's going to come back and bite you. So it was partly to do with that, that I had to rush and shoot this thing, and partly to do with conflicting personalities that I spent close to a year in post-production making this movie ready to be seen, because it was fraught with problems. And he talked about an editor that he wasn't vibing with for a majority of the time initially. Then he got the editor he wanted, and they recut the film in 14 days.
Wow.
To get it ready to be screened here. Pretty incredible. As I said, this is the final screen appearance of Kevin Kendall, who played H. He died shortly after filming wrapped from cancer, I believe. The music here is interesting mix. As I mentioned here, the Spanish composer, saxophonist Roque Baños did all the Spanish music that you hear. And the remix electronic music that you hear in the movie, that's by the English electronic band Uncle in collaboration there throughout. As of January 2022, the film has an approval rating of 87% on Rotten Tomatoes from 141 reviews. And as far as film, as far as awards for the film, Ben Kingsley was nominated for Best Supporting Actor at the Academy Awards, but lost to Jim Broadbent for Iris, which I don't remember that performance at all. And I love Jim Broadbent as an actor, which I think is a crime that Ben Kingsley didn't win at the Oscars, but he did win Best Supporting Actor at the Broadcast Film Critics Association, Boston Society Film Critics, Dallas-Fort Worth Film Critics, Florida Film Critics Circle, San Diego Film Critics Society, shout out, Southeastern Film Critics Association, and the Toronto Film Critics Association. He was nominated by SAG, losing to Ian McKellen at the SAG Awards for his performance of Gandalf there in The Fellowship of the Ring. He was nominated for a Golden Globe and an Academy Award, as I said, but both of them he lost to Jim Broadbent. The film also won Best Director and Best Screenplay at the British Independent Film Awards and had a special recognition for excellence in filmmaking from the National Board of Review. And that is all I have as post-film notes for Sexy Beast.
I just went to look up who the other people nominated are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's Ethan Hawke for Training Day, Ian McKellen for Lord of the Rings, and John Voight for Ali. Ooh. I 100% think Ben Kingsley should have won.
Yep.
I mean, I didn't see Iris, and maybe Jim Broadbent is fantastic. Oh, yeah,
it's a good film.
Yeah. But there's nothing like this performance. No. I mean, this is exactly the performance. And look, is Ethan Hawke bad in Training Day? No, he's totally good in Training Day.
Yeah.
Like, is Ian McKellen fantastic as Gandalf? Sure, he is. Yeah. But there is no performance like Don Logan in the history of film, as far as I'm concerned. There's no character like that.
He's an iconic villain.
Yeah.
And not just like Hans Gruber. Like, it's interesting what that was able to be in the film in Die Hard. This is real villainy that was brought to life by someone like Ben Kingsley there's no moment at the end where he's like, oh, you're just a thief. You know, there's no moment like that with Don. He is absolutely villain throughout. And at the end, even terrifying all the way to his final gasps of breath there in the film. So yeah, I agree with you. This is a performance that absolutely eclipses any of the other performances that were nominated
in
all those awards. All right, Steve, we've come to the end of the film. So usually you give me final thoughts first. I cede the floor to you, my friend. What are your final thoughts on Sexy Beast?
I'm so glad you suggested we do this. And it totally falls into this. This is an independent film. It looks like an independent film. Your story about the struggle, the year it took to edit the thing, it sort of reinforces, I think, the conversation we were having about how the nonlinear stuff happened. Because this is what happens in independent film is you just don't have the time. Sometimes you've got to move on to the next scene and you really didn't get it. You didn't make it work. Yeah. And in particular, connective tissues between things aren't quite working right. And it's interesting that this is a guy who 23 years later is nominated for Zone of Interest.
Yeah.
And that movie is incredibly controlled. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a movie where it feels like they went out and did exactly what they intended to do. Whereas this is much more of a movie where it is the intensity and energy and power of the performances, in particular Ben Kingsley and Ian McShane. Well, they're all great, but particularly Ben Kingsley, obviously, that elevates a movie which is kind of, you could tell, was shot kind of fast and loose because that's the budget they had. I think it is a fascinating film, and one of the most fascinating things about it is what we discussed is you don't care about the heist. What you care about is this couple or this foursome who you really, really like and you want them to survive. It's a movie, which is really, really odd. It's a movie that starts happy and ends happy, which is most movies start in one place and take you to a different place. The whole journey of this movie is to preserve the great life that we already had at the beginning to escape the boulder. It's all about escaping the boulder. And I think that makes it a totally fascinating film.
I think that should be a t-shirt, Escape the Boulder. I agree with you, right next to Release Your Man Rabbit. We should start making these shirts and merchandise. No, I agree 100% with you, Steve. You know, I love this movie. I thoroughly, thoroughly love this movie. I watched it four times to get ready for this particular episode because it's an hour and a half. It could easily, I put it on like 8 a.m. all four times that I watched it and just burned through it until 9:30, just rewatching, making sure I got the notes all right, making sure the dialogue was correct. And it was enjoyable each time. I never get tired of watching this movie because there is something inherent in this film that makes it unique and special. As you said, the heist isn't what we care about. It's Gal and Dee Dee. It's a love story wrapped up inside of this British crime tableau, shall I say. But it's about the love story. That's what this film, that's what makes it unique. There's blood, there's death, there's violence, there's gore, there's pain, there's all of that. But at the core of it is this love story. Is Gal going to make it back to Dee Dee? Are they going to survive Don Logan coming in to essentially try to break them apart? And I also think it's a message about how you can be happy with someone and you can be in love with someone. But just because you've ignored the past or ignored the terrible things in the back of your mind that has been like bothered you, or is a symbol of what you've done in your past, if you haven't come to terms with it, your happiness can be shattered at any moment. And so Don, in a way, is the subconscious, is this darkness, is their past coming to visit them, because he spews out their past to both of them throughout the movie to try to destroy their future. And by killing him and coming to terms with their past and having closure with their past, they now can truly be happy together by the end of the movie. So the movie is very much a love story and a very brutish reminder of how we have to reconcile with our past in order to have healthy relationships in our future. I know that's crazy to say because it's got great violence and great performances and truly terrifying people throughout the film. And it's very much a time capsule of 2000 British gangster movies. But I think it also works in the end, and why I come back to it, because I care about these two people at the center of it, Gal and Dee Dee, and I want them to make it by the end. And that's why the film moves me as well as it does. And phenomenal dialogue from the screenwriters. This is one that everyone should study when you're looking at how to make something stand out. Lewis Mellis and David Sinto, wonderful job with the dialogue and Glazer's direction here. And I love that Glazer has stayed who he is 23 years later, Steve, as you said, because we have this weird scene near the end of Zone of Interest. For those of you who don't know, we reviewed Zone of Interest on the Cinephage. You can listen to it on our podcast feed or watch it on YouTube. And that scene, in essence, is a scene that you would see in a Jonathan Glazer film when all of a sudden we go modern day. And it's one of those things that makes you question why that scene is in there. Why is the man rabbit in this movie? So keeping his trademark, shall we say, throughout even to now with something like Zone of Interest. So, but it's great to watch this film and see the beginning of Jonathan Glazer as a filmmaker and know that the promise is there and that it's been fulfilled in numerous ways in the years since. So, all right, well, that's our thoughts on Sexy Beast. Thank you all so much for listening to us. We appreciate it madly. Steve, what do we tell them to wrap up our shows all the time?
Well, we tell them we'd love to hear their thoughts on Sexy Beast, and they can visit us on our Facebook page. Just do a search for The Cinephiles. It's Cine_files on Twitter. It's The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. And of course, if you haven't subscribed to the show, we would love you to do so. You can do it on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on YouTube, where we do live shows once a month, where you can see our faces and we can interact with you. And of course, you can also support the show by going to Apple Podcasts and just hitting that subscribe button. That'll give you access to ad-free versions of the show, as well as our Cinephile shorts. We have a great one that just came out where John and I get a little bit argumentative with each other, I think. And I think it was a fantastic conversation. And you can also support the show at patreon.com/thecinephiles, where in addition to those tiers, we also have our watch-alongs, our advisory board, which meets once a month. And you can also buy or stream every movie we've ever reviewed at cinephiles.net. Oh, and you can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter and SR Morris 1 on Instagram. John, how about you?
You can reach me at The Roca Says on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, and The Outlaw Nation on Twitch. Thanks to Steve for letting me do this. I'll be trying to lead more of these as we go along. Not a lot of them, just every once in a while leading them, because I want to get the experience down. And so I thank Steve, my partner, for letting me do this on a film I truly love like Sexy Beast. And let me know what you thought about how I did leading this so I can have some pointers and constructive criticism to do better for the next time I lead one of these episodes. So thanks, Steve. Appreciate it.
And so I think that is it for this week. We will be back next time with another great film right here on The Cinephiles.